From the Korea Economic Institute in Washington, D.C., you're listening to Korean Context, news and analysis from the Korean Peninsula.
Hello, and welcome to Korean Context. My name is Kyle Ferrier, Director of Academic Affairs and Research at KEI, and I will be your guest host today. I am joined by Dr. Karen Pitak-Damrumgit, Assistant Professor at the Center for Multilateralism Studies at Nanyang University in Singapore. Karen and I discuss financial cooperation in East Asia, particularly the Chiang Mai Initiative and the Chiang Mai Initiative Multilateralization. Karen, it's a pleasure to have you here today.
Thank you, Kai. Thank you for having me here.
So, Karen, your research interests include regional economic governance in East Asia and international negotiations, and these two areas overlapped in a book you wrote last year on the role of negotiation tactics in the Chiang Mai Initiative Multilateralization, or the CMIM. Before we delve a bit deeper into the topic, could you talk a little bit about the history of the CMIM and its significance?
Yeah, sure. Okay. Let me brief you on the history of CMIM. Right? So, we have to trace it back to the year 1997, 1998, right? As you know, the Asian financial crisis, right, East Asia. And with it, it creates a lot of adverse effects on the economy is going down, and many East Asian nations went to IMF to seek support. Right? But the IMF policy was heavily criticized because they didn't better the situation, that they actually worsened the situation in, for example, in Korea, in Indonesia, in Thailand. And that led to common IMF aversion among East Asian countries, and that also created an regional impetus for creating a self-help regional mechanism that can provide liquidity or financial support to those who are in need of it.
So the CMI was in 97, 98, and then it was evolved into the CMIM in 2009. What were some of the main differences between the Chiang Mai Initiative and the Chiang Mai Initiative Multilateralization?
Okay, so the difference is that so CMI consists of a network of bilateral swap arrangement, but in contrast, CMIM is actually an effort to set up a multilateral swap network, which means that they're gonna lump together all swap network into a single contract.
Now, these agreements were clearly negotiated by the member states of ASEAN and South Korea, Japan, and China. Now, how is the nature of negotiations for regional economic initiatives in East Asia any different from other regions?
I think it's very interesting if you look into inside the CMIM negotiation dynamics, right? Because you have China and Japan, or East Asia, you have to understand that there's no clear single leader in the region. So China and Japan, they may take a role of core leadership, but there's also some elements of rivalry going on between these two countries, right? So that's one thing. Another thing is that ASEAN can also provide some kind of leadership to the ASEAN plus three process, right? As you know, ASEAN is considered as a less structural power than the plus three countries, right? But they sometimes, through my research and other research as well, that they actually managed to gain some marketing leverage over the more powerful Northeast Asian countries. So that's an interesting dynamic you look into, look inside CMIM negotiation processes. And also, we cannot forget the role of South Korea. South Korea plays a very interesting role. It knows its place well. It knows that it doesn't have a financial expertise or financial capacity or any other structural power on par with China and Japan, but it also realized that it has its caliber beyond the ASEAN nations. So then it knows that it can play a role of a middleman, manage a conflict among different parties inside CMIM. So I think that can also make the CMIM negotiation or financial negotiation in East Asia different from other regions.
So how has the structure of the CMIM been determined by processes of negotiation as opposed to the power dynamics among member states?
Well, actually, if you look into the structure of CMIM or CMA negotiation details, it's largely shaped by the process of negotiation rather than the power dynamics. Why do you say this, right? Because if you take a realist perspective or power dynamic perspective, you would argue that the more powerful state would gain more from the negotiation than the less powerful ones. But it doesn't really tell you exactly the outcome of the negotiation. Let me give you an example. For example, you could argue that China and Japan were more powerful than ASEAN country, and they should get a bigger piece of the pie. For example, they should get more contributions and voting power in CMIM than the ASEAN countries, right? Well, that's the case, but you cannot tell how much more they get. So the power dynamic argument can set only a range of possible outcome, but it cannot specify which outcome would happen at the end. So that's why we have to look into the process of negotiation in order to explain exactly why the outcome turned out to be the way that they did.
Now, when looking over at the academic discourse on the CMIM, most scholars of political economy tend to concentrate on the rivalry between Japan and China, or ASEAN as a regional leader. If Korea comes up, it's only in reference to how, when faced with the liquidity crisis in 2008, it's not help from the Fed rather than the Chiang Mai Initiative, which ultimately led to the Chiang Mai Initiative multilateralization in 2009. And however, in your book, you dedicate a chapter to Korea and Korea's role in reaching a final agreement in the CMIM, which I found quite interesting. How did Korea's negotiators shape not only their unique position in the CMIM, but also the overall structure of the organization of the institution?
Yeah, of course. So, as I mentioned earlier, South Korea occupies a very unique position, right? So it sees itself as a lesser power than China and Japan, but more than other nations. And it knows its place. When I think it's very, very interesting, when I wrote the chapter on Korea, it was a very fun chapter to write because it gives you an insight into how middle power like South Korea play its roles as a middleman and as a conflict reconciliator, and to push forward the CMIM process and also shape some of the key CMIM details. So maybe just let me give you some example of how Korean negotiator used their bargaining strategy and tactics to shape the negotiation outcome. Right? From my book, I found that South Korea influence shaped, for example, the breakdown of the CMIM contributions among the plus three countries. Right. So there was a heated debate among the Northeast Asian countries over what indicators that they will use to calculate the breakdown of financial contribution among themselves. So China proposed that they should use the foreign reserve to determine the financial contribution. As you know, China foreign reserve exceeded Japan at that time. So if they rely on this formula, China would come first in terms of voting powers and contribution amount. So that's why Japan argued strongly against the idea and counter proposed that they should use GDP as a key indicator to determine CMIM contributions among themselves. But that's also opposed by China too, because Japan GDP at that time more than China, right? So if you use GDP as a key indicator, then Japan would come first. So that's a rivalry going on between China and Japan in terms of could be the biggest contributors to CMIM. And the negotiation of that matter got stuck at somehow, so it couldn't move forward. But South Korea stepped in and said that, okay, let's settle this. Let's add one more indicator into the formula, which is the import and export values. So there were three indicators that you used to calculate the contributions of the plus three nations, which were foreign exchange reserve, GDP and import-export value. So that this is how South Korea tried to act as a middleman, act as a broker in order to settle this bill and move forward as the CMIM process.
Well, that's actually really interesting. One of the greatest strengths of the CMIM is the ability to neutralize the rivalry institutionally between Japan and China, and knowing that South Korea, I had no idea South Korea had such a key role in establishing that that mechanism. But earlier you had talked about realism, and I kind of want to go back to a little bit of international relations theory. And there are essentially three schools of thought: liberalism, realism, and constructivism. In relation to international negotiations, liberalism and realism assume states coerce or bargain with other states based on fixed interests, with power deriving from political and economic factors. Constructivism, on the other hand, emphasizes the role of ideas in social interaction, which in the case of the CMIM would concentrate on persuasion rather than bargaining in negotiations. From the extensive interviews that you conducted with government officials present at the negotiating table, were you able to gauge the impact of ideas and persuasion in negotiations? And in a more general sense, what role have ideas played in the structural organization of the CMIM?
Okay, sure. Also, very interesting questions, whether the rope idea or additional factor play a role at all in shaping the CMAM outcome, right? But from my study, it was there's some elements of ideas that drive the CMAM process and result, right? For example, CMAM is under the ASIN plus 3 framework. And this framework is actually underlined by what we call ASIN way or ASIN way of doing things, which is a set of principles that ASEAN countries use to manage their relation among themselves. The ASIN way was actually embraced by the Northeast Asian country, and that's why we have ASEAN way as a driving principle moving forward the ASEAN plus 3 process. So that's one element of idea that play a role here. But another element that I found through my study is there's a what we call a credibility element that has been a supporting factor helping South Korea to push forward the CMIM process and shape some of the outcome. From my study, I found that South Korea used what we call expertise in the drafting process of CMIM text. So what South Korea did, they hired professional lawyers to draft the text of the agreement itself. And by hiring a lawyer, it created a sense of credibility. South Korea gained credibility in the other's eyes, and that also helped speed up the drafting process of the CMMM text. So I think that there's a role of idea also play inside that story.
Now, if I could just pivot here a little bit from the negotiations to some of the challenges that the Chiang-Mai Initiative and the Chiang-Mai Initiative multilateralization face. One of the core challenges is that credit lines are linked to the IMF. In 1998, a member country could withdraw only 10% of its quota before an IMF conditionality program would be triggered. The threshold was raised to 20% in 2005, and again, it was raised in 2012 to 30%. The jump was expected to go to 40% in 2014, but we haven't seen that yet. To what extent do you think this is a function of the IMF being seen as a better manager of the moral hazard issue over regional measures such as the ASEAN Plus 3 Macroeconomic Research Office?
Well, we have to admit that the IMF has a longer track record than AMRO, right, or ASEAN Plus 3 Macroeconomic Research Office in terms of being serving as a civilian body. Right. So with a long track record, of course, IMF would come first in terms of being a better management of moral hazard than the AMRO, which was just in operation in Singapore since in the year 2010. But I think there are also other factors that also explain why the IMF dealing portion got stuck at 30% since the year 2012. I think the key factor is the conflict of interest between potential lenders on one hand and the potential borrowers on the other hand inside the CMAM framework, right? So if you think about that, potential lenders, they don't want to lose their money over bad policies, right? So they just want to ensure that they give money to the crisis economy and that the latter would carry out a sound macroeconomic policy. But on the other hand, the borrowers would like to get financial support with less strings attached. Right? So you can see a conflict of interest between the lender and the borrowers. And of course, with the scheme like this, CMIM, that provide liquidity support to the countries that are need of that money, of course, if you are a potential lender, you will have a more say in terms of rules and regulation over the lending matters.
Now, in February, AMRO, or the ASEAN Plus 3 Macroeconomic Research Office, was launched as an official international organization. Some reports suggest the organization will supplant the IMF for surveillance in the region, while others underplay the importance of this development. How significant do you think this move to internationalize or to make the AMRO an international organization is?
Okay, first of all, I think we should welcome AMRO as being upgraded into an IO, right? So it's a big step forward into pushing an AMRO, which used to be a corporate entity, into something like international organization, right? But I have some reservation about AMRO being an independent civilian body, because let me say this clearly, because in the CMIM agreement, if you look deeply into the text, AMRO is not really independent from power politics because, you know, in CMIM agreement says clearly that the executive level decision-making body, which consists of the deputy level officers of the Ministry of Finance and Central Bank of ASEAN plus three party, is mandated to oversee AMRO activity. So basically, the deputy level officer is mandated to oversee the activity or functions of this civilian body. So if you have a government, national government, oversee this and ensure the operation of surveillance mechanism, like how much independent can the activity of AMRO be conducted?
The Bank of China has made a number of bilateral swaps with countries that are also in the CMIM to promote the use of the yuan in trade transactions. But these swaps can also be accessed for emergency liquidity to finance a balance of payments deficit, which is the core purpose of the CMIM. The U.S. dollar equivalent of each agreement is also larger than the IMF delinked line of credit in the CMIM. Do you see these bilateral agreements as a potential challenge, whether intentional or not, to the dollar-denominated CMIM?
Well, I don't think that bilateral agreement is a potential challenge to CMIM. Of course, there's a number of bilateral swaps going on between Bank of China and the other central bank around the world. But you have to look behind the reason why the swap took place in the first place, right? It is because most of the swap, as you can find from the news, that it was actually driven by the arbitrage reason. So in order to gain more interest rates, so there was investor move currency across border. So of course, China is pursuing a strategy called renminbi, the yuan internationalization. But for that strategy to be successful, China needs a supporter, right? So the key factor about whether China bilateral agreement would be a challenge to CMIM, you have to ask yourself, what would be the interest of other East Asian nations, whether they would want to follow China or support the renminbi internationalization, right? That's evidence that some East Asian nation didn't really support China's strategy. Of course, you can look at Japan and South Korea, right? So they have the policy aligned more toward the U.S. or the U.S. Dollar center system. And also there's some reservation among some ASEAN policymakers. Some ASEAN countries didn't really want to rely much on the yuan, because if you know ASEAN history, you know that ASEAN don't want to be dominated by a single power. So that's why you see through our history that we tend to invite different players and try to make them hedge against each other and balance the power of the more powerful state.
Now, looking forward to the future, you know, it's generally accepted that crises have served as an impetus for creating and strengthening regional initiatives in East Asia. But do you think there is now enough collective ambition to see institutional advancements made proactively? What do you think the prospects are for the CMIM in particular?
Okay, so about the bilateral crisis, okay, we know that crisis can somehow trigger the regional efforts toward building a regional self-help mechanism, right? As we can see from the East Asian financial crisis in the late 1990s. The AFC, or Asian Financial Crisis, actually triggered the financial cooperation in East Asia, and now we have the ASEAN plus three process. But different crises create different effects, and if you look at the GFC, the recent global financial crisis, it didn't really trigger as much policy response that we witnessed after the Asian financial crisis. So what I worry about is there's a recent trend after the global financial crisis, the recent trend moving toward activism at individual level and global level. So what I mean by that is that after the financial crisis happened, most government rolled out policy at national level, for example, fiscal stimulus, and they try to enhance their roles and participation in a global level body such as G20 or IMF. So you can see that East Asian nation in the post-GFC era has been less enthusiastic in terms of pursuing the ASEAN plus three process. But I'm not saying that the regional cooperation is losing steam. I think it is a time where we witness less collective ambition at the regional level. Right? So what do I think about the prospect for the CMA in particular? Well, I think the prospect would hinge on three things. So one thing is the effect of the future crisis. We don't know when the future crisis will strike, right? But the future crisis can move the ASEAN plus three process forward or move CMA forward, just like the Asian financial crisis did in the late 1990s. The second factor that the future could hinge upon is the roles played by the ASEAN plus three nation themselves, right? So how will China and Japan cooperate with each other despite rivalry among themselves? And how can ASEAN provide some kind of leadership to the system? And how can South Korea would play a role again as a party who reconcile conflict, playing a balancing role between Japan, China, and ASEAN? And another factor that the future could hinge upon is the security environment. What I mean is that there's several territorial disputes going on among East Asian nations, right? So you can see like South China Sea, and there also a territorial dispute between among ASEAN nations, also between Malaysia and Indonesia. So although we don't have a solid evidence to conclude that the security tension, the tension in security realm, was actually have a direct effect onto the East Asian financial regionalism. But I don't think we can completely ignore what happened in the security sphere. Because if you have a security tensions among yourself, among ASEAN plus three nations, that's going to erode trust among these parties, right? And trust is an important element for a successful cooperation in the future.
Thank you very much, Karen. It's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you today, and thank you for traveling all this way to speak with me.
Well, thank you for having me, Kai.
That's all for this episode of Korean Context. As always, thank you so much for listening. Please subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or wherever else you get your podcasts, and we'll see you here again next week.